Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us for hour two. Jimmy Akin continues as our guest this hour, and we continue with open forum. So your call is welcome, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. No questions so far that seem far off the beaten path this time. Every now and then we get a kind of out of left field one. Although I must say I don't recall ever having heard the question, what are the bodies of the damned like? I like those kind of, you know, things I never thought of. And
they occur to people.
Bodies of the Damned sounds like the name of a movie, doesn't it?
Or a rock band.
Oh, yeah, Bodies of the Damned would be a good rock band. The number is 888-318-7884. I might have said that already. I don't know, but you probably could stand hearing it again. A lot of folks on the line. Do I ever get to ask questions, Jimmy? Because I want you to tell me where all the aliens are, like we were talking about
in space.
Break. Is that where they keep them?
Yeah.
You know the question that Enrico Fermi asked.
Where is everybody?
Where is everybody? But you feel
known as the Fermi paradox. I did a whole episode of Mysterious World on it.
Oh, did you come up with do you have a favorite answer of where is everybody?
No, I don't. I'm open to a number of different solutions. I think some are more likely than others, but the truth is we haven't found them, and there could be any number of explanations for that.
No. All right. They could be in New Mexico. I guess that's one possibility.
Some of them could.
Yep. Josh in Chicago, Illinois, watching on YouTube. You are first this hour, Josh. Thanks for waiting around. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I wanted to echo real quick what the Swiss caller said in the first hour. Me and a friend of mine just started taking Jimmy's beginner apologetics course on the School of Apologetics, and we love it. So thank you for that, Jimmy, first off, and I recommend it to anybody.
Awesome. Thank you. I have a new one on, it's called Evidence for Christ, that it's already been filmed and I'm working on the study guide right now and they're doing the video editing. So that will also be one of our key courses in our sequence, Evidence for God, Evidence for Christ, which is mine, and Evidence for the Church. So check that out when it comes out.
Okay, great. I'll definitely have to keep a lookout for that. So my question is about atonement theology. So this is something new to me, and I want to kind of know what the Church teaches on this, or if it's more theological speculation. But as I understand it, the difference is between sort of the Protestant view of penal substitution versus the way I've heard it, what we believe, vicarious suffering. Is that right? Could you explain that for me a little bit?
Okay, so the Church hasn't carefully, hasn't infallibly defined a particular theory of the atonement. And actually, I think that multiple theories are compatible. One that tends to be disfavored is penal substitution, which is found in some Protestant circles, but like so many other things, it's not found in all Protestant circles. So it is a Protestant view, but it's not the Protestant view. A common way of characterizing the common Catholic theological opinion, as opposed to church teaching, but the common theological opinion in Catholic circles is often characterized as a term known as vicarious satisfaction. So, in order to understand the difference between penal substitution and vicarious satisfaction, it's fairly straightforward. The answer is in the word. So, Cy Kellett, we're going to play Define That Word.
Okay, I love this game.
Okay, substitution. What would that mean in the context of discussing Jesus's death and the atonement?
I would say replacing one for us.
Correct, yes. Right. Jesus is our substitute. He does something on our behalf, so he's our substitute. What does the word vicarious mean?
Oh, that's a tough one to define. Vicarious, that would mean his doing it. I don't know how to make a distinction there. Actually,
okay.
I don't know why. Well, I'm just running into a brick wall on that one.
The Latin term vicarious means substitute.
Oh,
that's what a vicarious.
Oh, that's
what
I see. I was trying to come up with a distinction, and there was no distinction there.
Yeah, not in that case.
Trick question.
It's a legitimate question.
Yeah.
It's a different word. But they mean the same thing. And so both of these ideas, and by the way, if you ever like watch British television, you'll sometimes see clergymen who are referred to as vicars.
Yeah.
That's from, you know, like I'm the new vicar. That is from that vicar is a shortened English form of vicarious. And so the vicar is the substitute for the bishop in taking care of a parish. In any event, so in both penal substitution and vicarious satisfaction, we have Jesus substituting for us. And that means the difference is going to be found in the two other words, penal and satisfaction. Those are going to tell us how he is functioning as our substitute. So, what does the word penal mean?
Punished.
Punished, that's right. That's why our penal justice system is our justice system that punishes criminals. So penal means connected with punishment. And so the idea of penal substitution is that not only did Christ die on the cross for us, but God was punishing him on the cross in our place. So he substitutes for us as the victim of God's punishment. Okay, what does not punishment, but satisfaction mean?
Kind of like to fulfill what's owed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So to satisfactio in Latin would mean, I mean, you could take it back to its root part. Satis means enough, and factio would mean to make. So it's to make something enough. You do something enough to accomplish something. Well, So on the vicarious satisfaction model, Christ is not being punished in our place, but on our behalf, he is satisfying God's justice. He's offering his life as a sacrifice in love for us, and so that satisfies God's justice and allows God to forgive us. So one of these is punishment-based, penal substitution, and the other is love-based. It's vicarious satisfaction. Christ is making satisfaction for us. He's compensating God for our sins by offering this loving sacrifice. Now, in terms of why might one want to adopt penal substitution? And like I said, not all Protestants do. A lot of Protestants are actually quite opposed to the idea of penal substitution, but there are some verses that can kind of be read in this way, but there's really only one passage, and it's Isaiah 53, that sounds like punishment is happening. You know, God laid on him the stripes of us all. Okay, well, when you lay stripes on someone, that means you whip someone. God laid on him the punishment of us all, things like that. It's really only this one chapter, and it's highly poetic. And so that means we have to be on our guard about should this be taken literally or not. Well, if it was taken literally, God would be literally punishing his son, who is infinitely holy. Psychelet, would it be just to literally punish a supremely innocent man?
That would be horribly unjust.
Is God horribly unjust?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so many, many Protestants and many Catholics look at that theory and say, no, it would mean God is being horribly unjust. He cannot be literally punishing Jesus. We need to understand this in some other way. And to my mind, the obvious way to interpret it is in terms of a sacrifice, because that's what that's the image that the New Testament presents us with for what Jesus did on the cross for us. He was our sacrifice. He was our Passover lamb that is sacrificed on our behalf. He's the Lamb of God that is sacrificed on our behalf. So that sacrifice image goes much better with the theological elaboration of vicarious satisfaction. You know, in the in the Old Testament, if you had committed a sin and you wanted to be reconciled with God, you'd take, say, a lamb, and you'd go to the temple and you'd sacrifice it to compensate God for the thing you had done wrong. So you're making personal satisfaction by giving of your wealth to compensate God, at least symbolically. Well, Jesus, because the blood of bulls and goats can never take away sin, as Hebrews says, Jesus offered his own life to make that sacrifice and thus that satisfaction on our behalf.
Josh, I think that was a lot. Does that all make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm still here. Thank you very much, Jimmy. God bless you both.
Thank you. And thanks
you
for,
too.
For the lots of kind words for Jimmy's teaching today. So I'm very glad to get that. I got to take a break. Right, Sarah? All right, let's take a break.
Yes.
Be right back. More Open Forum.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I like the answers where I get to participate, but not by defining words that are pretty much exactly the same word, and it didn't occur to me like, oh, those are the same. But that was
it adds drama.
Is I gonna know this or not?
Because
I always remember the time Jimmy said to me, was Joseph Jesus's biological father? And I was a little bit not paying attention, and I said yes. And Jimmy goes, what? And I went, wait, hold on, back up. That was embarrassing. So I'll never live that one down.
Don't worry, Si. No. Even Homer nods.
That's right. Even Homer nods.
And I'm not talking Homer Simpson. He nods a lot.
Yes, he does. Oh, I thought that was you were comparing me to Homer Simpson, which I...
No. The other Homer, the famous one.
Yeah, the poetic one. Dennett in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You are up next. Dennett, let me just get the right line here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. So I have a question. Do Protestants believe that Mary is the mother of God?
Some of them do, yeah. In fact, the more theologically educated they are, the more they tend to believe that, because, you know, there is, in kind of on the popular level in many Protestant communities, a resistance to that idea. You know, it's like, well, Mary is obviously a creature. How could she be the mother of God? And she's obviously, you know, Jesus has existed from all eternity and Mary hasn't. So how could she be the mother of God? So you do have a kind of popular level presentation of the Protestant faith that at times will reject the idea that Mary is the mother of God. But then when you sit down and think about it and say, well, okay, what's a mother? A mother is someone who has a person in their womb. Did Mary have the person of Jesus in her womb? Yes. So Mary is the mother of Jesus. Is the person Jesus God? Yes. So transitively, Mary is the mother of God. And that's something that at least the major reformers at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation did not dispute. They acknowledged Mary's the mother of God, and the more theologically oriented members of the Protestant community, you know, theologians and so forth, have tended to recognize that as well. It's more on the popular level where you have confusion on this point.
Does that help you, Dennett?
It sure does. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very, very much. The number's 888-31-TRUTH. On we go. Peter in New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. You are next, Peter. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good evening, Sai and Jimmy. A question I have is there any provision for the church to remove a pope from office if he seems to be totally mentally incapable of carrying out the office?
Not in canon law. In canon law, there is no provision whatsoever for removing a pope without his voluntary resignation. The only way it would work is, at least in canon law, is the pope can, if he doesn't die, the only other way out of office for him is for him to voluntarily resign. Now, you could have a situation where a pope has become mentally incapacitated, at which point his advisors could go to him and say, Your Holiness, we've noticed you've been faltering and you seem to be suffering from some of the effects of age or dementia or whatever it may be. We suggest that you go get a medical diagnosis. And if you are suffering from significant cognitive impairment, do you think it would be better for the church to be led by someone who is not suffering from significant cognitive impairment? And so they could kind of encourage him to resign, but they couldn't remove him from office. You notice, though, I said, according to canon law, and by that I mean what's published, what's in the code of canon law. However, popes can make other arrangements. They can write private letters that are never publicized that say, I resign under if the following conditions are met. A famous one of these was by Pius XII. Back during World War II, Pius XII was engaged in a conflict with Hitler. It was largely out of the public eye, but the two men hated each other. And when Hitler was invading Italy to prop up Mussolini, Pius XII believed that they're just going to roll up to the Vatican and arrest me and try to use me for propaganda purposes. They're going to try to, you know, imprison me somewhere and you know, try to get some kind of political advantage out of having me, the Pope, as their prisoner. And he was determined not to have that happen. And so he wrote a letter, which he then notified people at the Vatican of, that said, if I am taken captive by the Nazis, I hereby resign, go to a neutral country and elect a new pope. Because he didn't want Hitler having the pope in his power. And so he left a letter that specified the conditions on which he would resign. And it's possible that other popes can do the same thing. Some of them may have, and we just never learned about it. A pope could say, if, you know, for any reason I am unable to carry out the duties of my office in the judgment of the following cardinals, I resign. And so to this point, this kind of procedure has not been added to the Code of Canon Law, but we do know that popes have previously used unpublicized procedures to deal with eventualities, you know, at least generally along these lines, where they resign if the following conditions are met. And hypothetically, an arrangement like this could exist right now, and we simply don't know about it. But I suspect in the future this will become more regularized, and we're likely to get more acknowledgement of this kind of arrangement. But it has to be based, no one can force a pope out of office, so it has to be based on the resignation of a pope voluntarily.
All right, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Man, I hope it doesn't come to that, because I mean, you see the controversy even when a pope resigns and he's clearly in his right mind.
Well,
for what happened otherwise.
We're in a new world medically.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you can prolong life beyond functional capacity a lot now.
Right.
And do you really want to have someone who could be alive for decades in charge of the church who is fundamentally incapacitated?
Yeah. No.
You know, right. And you know, they may not even have the ability to resign the way Pope Benedict did. I mean, if someone, let's say you have the Pope, he's 70 years old, he has a stroke and is confined to a wheelchair and is not verbal. He could live for 25 years.
Yeah. Right.
With modern medical technology, unable to speak a word or make a single or communicate a single decision.
Yeah,
so
that could be, right.
I think it would be advantageous for popes to leave living wills, if you want, about when they under what conditions would it be their will to resign.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've had the sense that, he didn't say this, but it seemed to me that Pope Benedict anticipated this as well and wanted, I mean, you could
to
say,
set
well,
a precedent.
Yeah, to yeah. set a precedent, because there's hundreds of years with no resignations of popes. Yeah, but the medical conditions are totally different now than they were even 50 years ago. So you would expect more resignations now, at least I would. Peter, very interesting question. Thanks very, very much. Michael in Columbus, Ohio, listening on Ave Maria Radio. You are next, Michael. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, hi, Jim. This is my first time talking to you. Hello. Hey. So I'm from Ghana, okay? Mm-hmm. And living here in Columbus, Ohio. And I've been wondering, okay, this is just weird. So I've been wondering that, okay, God created man and woman and all the good stuff. And I'm wondering how... Oh, is there any history in the Bible somewhere that states something about Africa, especially the dark color, as mm-hmm. to their creation? Because we don't have anything that states anything how they came to be all of a sudden. It's like, okay, Adam and Eve, Israelites, you know, and it's all mm-hmm. about it's basically like light skin. So I'm trying to figure out, I know this is going to be a very weird question for you, but I'm sorry. I just have to know.
Okay. This is not weird for Jimmy.
Is there anything in the Bible that states or has any record of, you know, the creation of blacks or how they came to be and,
yeah.
Even if not in the Bible, like in theology, something that you guys have that we don't know that you can state on, okay, how they came to be and their color and stuff like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are a few things to say here, and this is a very interesting question, and we don't have a lot of time before the break, so I'm going to need to finish this after the break.
Okay.
But the first thing to say is, well, we do have, we don't have any indication that Adam and Eve were white. They're often pictured that way in artwork, but we don't have any indication of what their skin tone would have been. So that's completely unknown. In terms of the different skin complected races in the Bible, we do have mention, you know, of black people, folks from sub-Saharan Africa. Moses, in fact, was married to a woman from Ethiopia, which in biblical times was known as Cush. And after his first wife, who was from the Middle East, after she died, he married a Cushite woman. And in fact, there is a very interesting story where Moses's brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, start complaining about Moses's wife. And it seems that Miriam took the lead in complaining about Moses's Cushite wife. And to punish her for the disrespect she was showing, God gave her leprosy temporarily. And she was, it says in the text, she was white as snow. So it's kind of like God saying, you got a problem with the Cushite wife? You want white? I got your white right here, and she becomes leprous. So this is an indication that that God doesn't care about your skin color. We're all equal to Him. In terms of the question of how did this come about, it's something that we're not told in any direct way. The closest that we come to an explanation is found in early Genesis after the flood. After the flood, Noah has, you know, the three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so the flood ends in chapter 9 of Genesis. And then in chapters 10 and 11, we have the diffusion of the human race, the repopulation of the earth in the wake of the flood. And as part of that, we have something called the Table of Nations, which we'll talk about more after the break.
Michael, I hope you can hang on through the break because we have to take this break. It's not one I have a choice about. But very interesting question all about how is race dealt with in the Bible, and is there a record, as Jimmy's already covered, of African-American folks in the Bible, African folks in the Bible. More right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Marriage has its challenges.
However, what are true roles and callings as a husband and wife?
We will talk about that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to more of Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
There's a little bit of that groovy music. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Michael on the line in Columbus, Ohio, originally from Ghana, asking about how race is handled in the Bible, particularly if there's anything there about where darker-skinned people come from. And I said African-American people in the Bible. No, that is not correct. There are African people in the Bible, sub-Saharan African people in the Bible, but no Americans of any kind in the Bible. Michael, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. And okay. Jimmy's in the midst of his answer.
So after the flood, Noah's family spreads out and starts to repopulate the earth. And in Genesis chapter 10, we have a passage known as the Table of Nations. And what it is essentially a collection of different ethnic groups that are attributed to, here's how they descend from Noah. So you have Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and you have this group of about 70 different national ethnic groups, and it tries to relate them in terms of a genealogy linking them to Noah. And among them is Cush. Cush, as I said, is the biblical name for Ethiopia, and Cush is said to be a descendant of Ham. So you got the three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Cush is a descendant of Ham. But there's we have to be a little careful here, because this is in this passage occurs in the prehistory. This is before Abraham. It's before the Israelites had historical records. And it's pretty clear that when you study the Table of Nations carefully, that it's not meant to be taken as a literal biological genealogy. And that's something that can be confusing to us today, because when we think of genealogies, we think of them as being biological. You know, if you have a father and a son in a genealogy, Sykelet, usually the father is the biological father of the son, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Is that always the case, though?
Well,
can you ever think of a case where a father in a genealogy is not the biological father of his son that's listed in the genealogy?
I have one that comes to mind, Jimmy.
Uh-huh.
And that would be Joseph as the father of Jesus.
Okay, so that's a foster fatherhood situation.
Yeah.
There are others, and I wasn't going to the Bible at that point.
Oh,
just
okay.
Like
all right.
Today, in a genealogy, you may have a family genealogy, but somebody may have been adopted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you could adopt someone as your son. And in that case, they go into the genealogy for the family, even though they're not your biological offspring. Well, the same thing was true in ancient Israelite society. Because they were a patriarchal society, they were organized along genealogical lines. So if you wanted to, say, join Israel, you needed to fit into the family structure somehow. It wouldn't make sense. So you're an Israelite. Well, which one of the 12 tribes do you belong to? None of them. Well, then how are you an Israelite? So what they would do is posthumously adopt you into one of the tribes. So, for example, Caleb, we're told he's actually not an Israelite by origin, but he gets adopted into the tribe of Judah. And so Judah had died centuries earlier, but now Caleb is a descendant of Judah by adoption. And this is how, and it's not just the Israelites who would do this. Arab tribes like Bedouins do this today. If you like marry into a family, you need to be put into the genealogy, and they say you have been genealogized. So you do this posthumous adoption to give you an ancestor within the group. Well, so we know this is how their genealogies worked. And really, when you study the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, that's what they're doing here. They're creating a legal genealogy to relate all of these different cultural groups to each other. It's not meant to be literal and biological. And you can see that, for example, in terms of our skin tone question, by looking at the other sons of Ham. So we're told, this is Genesis 10:6, the sons of Ham are Cush, so that's Ethiopia, that's quite dark skin. Egypt, okay, not as dark skin. Egyptians have a kind of middle tone skin that's dominant in Egypt. They're not as light as Europeans, but they're not as dark as sub-Saharan Africans. Put, that's Libya, and Libyans tend to be on the lighter side of things. And Canaan. And Canaanites also tend to be on the lighter side of things. So right there in the sons of Ham, you've got several different skin tones. So this is not a literal biological genealogy. It's a legal genealogy that relates these groups to each other, principally based on their languages. Scholars have looked at it and said, okay, these groups tend to fall into language groups rather than biological groups. So how did racial diversity develop in the world? Well, the Bible doesn't really tell us, and so that means it's a matter of science. You know, we need to look to science for the answer. Well, according to the current best science, the human race first developed in Africa and in sub-Saharan Africa. And because of the climatic conditions and all the direct sunlight coming down on Africa, the human race originally appears to have been black, because you need that extra melanin in your skin. Melanin is the pigment in our skin that protects us from the sun. It's kind of like natural suntan lotion or natural sunscreen. And Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, got a lot of direct sunlight because of the equator. And so people there developed to have darker colored skin to protect them from the sun. But then several tens of thousands of years ago, the human race started to migrate out of Africa. At least our most immediate ancestors, Homo sapiens, did. Others, like Homo Neanderthal, had left earlier. But some Homo sapiens ended up in very northern climates, like my ancestors ended up in northern Europe. And in northern Europe, the sun does not strike at the same angle. So you're not getting as intense sunlight. And as a result of that, since our skin makes vitamin D for us, which is a very essential hormone, our skin makes vitamin D for us from sunlight. My ancestors were not making enough vitamin D because the melanin in their skin was blocking the sunlight that they needed to make vitamin D. And so over the course of time, they started to lose all of that extra melanin. Their ancestors in Africa had needed it to protect them from the sun. But in northern Europe, they needed to lose it so they could get enough sunlight into their skin to make the vitamin D that they needed. And so that's how we ended up with different racial groups. It was a slow process over a long period of time, but it was based on the climatic conditions where people were living and what they needed, whether they needed protection from really intense sunlight or whether they needed to have lighter skin so they could get more sunlight and make the vitamin D they needed.
Michael, does that satisfy what you were looking for?
Yes. You are so good. Thank you so much. God bless you. This is so awesome. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And hopefully other people have heard it. So that will really ease a lot of mindset because mostly we don't get that education like this. And this is awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to hear from you and always great to hear from someone from Africa. It's really cool. You're from Ghana.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you. Maybe we'll hear from you again. The number here is, I'll give it out, but I don't know. We got a lot of folks on the line. 888-318-7884. You can give it a try. We'll see. Maybe there will be opportunity to get to your question. Up next is Tim in Washington, listening on 102.9 FM. Tim, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, can you tell me who coined the word saint? This is kind of a carryover from last weekend, but is that a carryover from Judaism, or is that strictly a Christian word?
Okay, so we got to be a little careful in how we parse this, because saint is an English word and it comes from a Latin word, but there is a Hebrew equivalent of it. Basically, the word saint just means holy. So a saint is a holy person. And you did have people who were described as holy or saints in the Old Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew term kadosh tended to not refer to a human being, but to an angel. It was more common to refer to angels as holy ones or saints. But then in the New Testament, you continue to have holy angels referred to as saints, although using the Greek word hagios, which also means holy. And so the hagioi, the holy ones, could be saints, but they also could be human beings, because Christians and Jewish people are also described as God's holy ones or God's saints. Then, as the Christian faith began to be popular among Latin-speaking people, they would use the Latin term sanctus. Sanctus means the same thing as kadosh. And it means the same thing as hagios. It just means holy or holy one. And so so you had people referring to a holy person as a sanctus. So you'd have people referring to Sanctus Petrus, holy Peter, or Sanctus Paulus, holy Paul. And then because English inherits a lot of words from Latin, English got the word sanctus, but English lost its noun endings. That us on the end of Sanctus, that actually changes form in Latin, and English didn't like all those changing forms, the ends of nouns changing so much. So it got rid of them, and you got Sanct. And then over the course of time, the vowel shifted in Sanct, and you got Saint. And so Saint is an English word. We get it from the Latin Sanctus, which is the Latin equivalent of Hagios, which is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew Kadosh, and they all mean Holy One. So yes, there wasn't a single person who did this. It was just, there's no single person who coined this term, but it developed organically over the course of the centuries among God's people.
And Tim, I got to leave it there because I got to take the break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. You know that little thing that you were just doing, Jimmy, how we came out of Africa and then you lose the melanin? I wonder, because human history is really long. I wonder if there's any like white people, you know, they got all white and then their tribe or whatnot moved south and then they got and they started getting the melanin again. You think there's anybody like that?
I'm not familiar with that. I can't rule it out that it would happen. But what tends to happen with lighter skinned people when they go into areas that have more intense sunlight is they just burn.
Yeah.
And they get suntanned. Yeah. And suntan actually can happen with darker skinned people too. You know, even if someone is a sub-Saharan African, if they spend more time in the sun, their skin's going to get darker.
Right.
And if they spend more time in an office building, their skin will get lighter. So tanning is a universal human phenomenon. But typically what happens with genetics is a use it or lose it strategy, because we build up over the course of time genes that will produce a particular effect. And if we aren't using those genes, if they're not performing a useful function, then they will tend to erode over time. And so that's how people lost in Northern Europe. That's how they lost their melanin. They originally had genes that had developed in Africa that were making melanin in their skin. But then when they moved to Northern Europe, that became a disadvantage.
Yeah,
and so the genes that made melanin started to deteriorate and they broke. They got to the point where they were no longer making that much melanin, which was a good thing. And it promoted the survival value of the offspring because now they could make the vitamin D they needed in a Northern European climate. But the thing is that once genes degrade, it is not likely that they will go
back. Oh, yeah.
Because there's not like a, okay, how do we repair this broken code here? It can, a feature can re-evolve, but it's not as easy as just going back and fixing the thing that eroded.
Ah, that makes sense. All right. Where am I going now? Mike in Green Bay, Wisconsin, watching on YouTube. You're next, Mike. Not a lot of need for melanin up there in Green Bay, Wisconsin, but go ahead, Mike.
Need for a lot of cheese.
Hey, wait a minute. It was It was 72 today. I needed it.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. That's a
it's not the temperature, it's the angle of the sunlight.
Yeah.
Well, it will be 39 tomorrow, they said. That's the way it goes.
I've seen pictures of Lambeau Field. I know there is a point at which there's not much sun left in Green Bay.
Not much at all. My question, kind of an odd angle to come to it from, I guess, mm-hmm. but I know private revelation, as far as the church is concerned, is a you-can-believe-it-if-you-want type of a thing. Mm-hmm. Does the church have any thoughts or any teaching on near-death experiences or visions? I guess you could say that people in the process of dying tend to have in hospitals, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we want to clarify our terms. The term near-death experience was coined by a researcher named Raymond Moody for his 1970s book, Life After Life. And it refers, the proper term, near-death experience, refers to a complex of things that are often reported by people who either are in danger of dying or who have gotten very close to death or who have actually clinically died and then had their heartbeat restarted and they end up surviving. And these experiences include things like a kind of transition. It's very commonly reported, for example, here in the West, that it's like going through a tunnel. And so you have this experience, it's like going through a darkened tunnel and there's a light at the other end of the tunnel. And that's a common experience, but it's not universal. Some people have other transitional experiences. In Japan, instead of the tunnel, they commonly perceive this as crossing a bridge. But you can see how in both cases, it's a transition. It's you're moving from one, you appear to be moving from one location to another. I wonder if that's also behind the Greek myth of Styx, which was the river that Charon, the ferryman, would bring you across at when you died in Greek mythology. That's another kind of transitional motion experience. And so I'm wondering if they were getting that as their way of imagining what happens in near-death experiences. Then once you have the tunnel experience, or even if you don't, you may perceive yourself as floating above your body, and you may see what people are doing trying to revive you as you're in the medical room. Your spirit may travel elsewhere. It may move, if you die in a hospital, your spirit may move around the hospital and see other things happening in the hospital that you come back and they turn out to be true. You know, they can be verified, in which case they're called veridical. You may encounter a being of light. You may have a review of everything you did during your life. You may see a very beautiful location, like a very beautiful city or garden. You may encounter a threshold, and you're told if you go across this threshold, you won't go back to being alive. This is the point of no return. You may be given a choice. Do you want to return, or do you want to cross the threshold? Or you may be told by the being of light, this is not your time, you're going back. And so those are some of the phenomena that are commonly reported in near-death experiences. Near-death experiences are distinct from other near-death phenomena, which Mike also referred to. So, for example, when people are in the process of dying, they will frequently experience other things. One of them is known as terminal lucidity. And terminal lucidity is a sudden restoration of mental function. Someone may have been suffering from dementia for decades, and they may be completely incapacitated. And then shortly before their death, for maybe an hour or two, everything comes back online, and they're able to make peace with their friends and family and say their goodbyes. And then the dementia comes back and they die. But terminal lucidity is a known near-deathbed phenomena. That's what they're sometimes called to distinguish them from near-death experiences, deathbed phenomena. Another is visitations, where someone is dying and they perceive and have conversations with people who are not visible in the room. And these may be interpreted as angels or as deceased loved ones who have come to greet them and help them transition into the afterlife and let them know before you die, it's going to be okay and stuff like that. So these are very common as well. Also, because dying is a traumatic experience, sometimes people who are dying have what are called crisis apparitions. A crisis apparition is an apparition of a living person. The person is still alive, but they appear to someone at a distant location because they're in this crisis. They're kind of reaching out for help in some way. And these crisis apparitions can occur shortly before death or in the act of death or even shortly after death. And they also may be related to saying goodbye to people. You know, like if it's right after death and you appear to someone and, you know, even if you don't say anything, you appeared to them and then they learn you died. And it's like, okay, that was kind of a goodbye. So all of these phenomena are reported and parapsychologists study them. I've taken classes in some of these things and they're very interesting. They are not required for belief. Now, as you say, Mike, even approved church apparitions are not required belief. When the church investigates a private revelation of, say, the Virgin Mary, and it approves it, what it means is, well,
Jimmy froze on.
Contrary to the...
Sorry, you froze on us for a second, Jimmy, but... Oh, Jimmy froze on us again. Mike in Green Bay, I'm going to check back in with you. Is this all making sense to you, Mike? Did we lose Mike too?
It is, and I'm just.
Oh, go ahead, Mike. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
No. I'm just. I think I'm tracking on where Jimmy's going, which is, you know, if you want to believe it, go ahead. I guess I was just wondering if the church really had anything that they've published, yes or no, or maybe, or go ahead, or, you know, or as Jimmy likes to say, sometimes it's more science than faith. I guess I'm not sure which.
Okay. And this is a case where it's more science than faith, at least when it comes to deathbed experiences and near-death experiences. The faith doesn't really have a lot to say in this area. And so, you know, what's going on in these cases is something that parapsychologists have studied. And there are Catholic parapsychologists, but the church doesn't have any magisterial teachings in this area. So it's a fascinating subject that needs more study, but thus far the church hasn't chosen to address it in an authoritative doctrinal way.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
No problem.
Thank you very, very much. Enjoy the 72 degrees, and I'm sorry about the 39 degrees tomorrow, but I don't know. I guess that's Green Bay, Wisconsin in the month of November. Jimmy, could I just clarify one thing? So
yeah,
that all being the case, what you just said, we're not forbidden from believing in these things. We're not required to believe it.
Why would we be? It'd be like, are you forbidden to believe in a scientific theory?
Yeah, no. Fair enough.
You know, if something isn't contradicting the faith, you're free to believe it.
I'm just wondering how can I, between now and the time I die, I would like to somehow get the Japanese bridge in and get the tunnel out. I don't want to go through a tunnel, but I'd be happy to go over the Japanese bridge.
Well, talk to the afterlife construction department and they
yes!
can probably arrange a bridge situation rather than a tunnel situation.
Yeah, all right. If you're listening, afterlife people, I would like the Japanese bridge. I don't want the dark, dark tunnel. Jimmy Akins has been our guest. Tomorrow, a new episode of Jimmy Akins' Mysterious World will drop, and it's on that mysterious
staircase.
Yeah, in the chapel in New Mexico. Thanks, Jimmy. I really enjoyed the 2 hours.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.